Hello, everybody, and welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, the series of podcasts from the Royal College of Anaesthetists.
My name is Dr. Paul Southall. I'm a consultant anaesthetist working at the Worcestershire Acute Hospitals NHS Trust, and I'm also a council member at the Royal College, as well as the sustainability lead for the Royal College.
We're recording this special podcast from our Anaesthesia 2025 conference in Belfast. I'm joined for this special podcast by Professor Helen Higham, who has just given the QE lecture at our conference here today. Helen is an associate professor in the Nuffield Department of Clinical Neurosciences at the University of Oxford and a consultant anaesthetist at the Oxford University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. She's also the associate dean for simulation and patient safety at Health Education England in Thames Valley. She's here to talk today about all things human factors and healthcare and anaesthetics in particular. Helen, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here. Enjoying our conference so far?
Absolutely. Fundamentally love Belfast, and thank you, Belfast, for the weather. Can't believe it. It's broad sunshine. I mean, it's just ridiculous, isn't it? So I noticed the college has been organising runs as well, which so far I've managed to avoid, but tempted tomorrow.
We can pick you up on that later, maybe. So we might as well just dive straight into it. So human factors, anaesthesia, why? Why the interest? How did all this come about?
I think it's a bit like what I said at the end of the lecture, which is that as a specialty, we are so well suited to thinking about systems in a holistic way. So we consider our patients as human beings, a complex set of interdependent organ systems, and our job is to support those organ systems and to keep people safe. And so it's very natural to apply that kind of thinking to healthcare systems as well. And I think it's why we're very comfortable. And it's not even just a way of thinking. It's the fact that as anaesthetists, we work with everyone in the hospital. I can remember I used to give this talk a long time ago about why choose anaesthesia? What's it like as a profession? I used to say, oh yeah, we work with everyone in the hospital apart from the pathologist. And then one of my mates, who's a pathologist in Oxford, said, no, I do work with anaesthetists. He said, all my breast biopsies I do with sedation. So yes, I work with anaesthetists. I thought, that's it. We work with everyone, you know? So you get real insights into how work is done in so many different areas, not just theatre. And I think that's crucial. And it's why, for me, it's become a very natural interest, not just in terms of teaching, but also in terms of research.
Is it still valid to make the comparisons between healthcare and the aviation industry, or is it becoming a bit of a tired cliche these days?
I think I get a bit frustrated with people that go, stop talking about aviation. I think respect is due. What they have done has been absolutely remarkable in terms of driving down safety incidents, ensuring that we all feel very comfortable getting on an aeroplane because we know the people in the cockpit have used the checklist. They have paid attention and they have checked everything that they should, so we all feel safe. So no, I still think they're a prime example of how to do this kind of thing properly. I do think healthcare is different, and I think that was my point around the fact that we are a complex adaptive system. I think the interdependencies are greater. The resource constraints are more obvious in healthcare than perhaps in civil aviation. So there are things where we're different. Dare I say, it's also the case where pilots and air crew are concerned, there's a very real risk for them if something goes wrong. It's slightly different in healthcare. And I do think that still that plays a part in us perhaps not engaging as proactively as we might. And that's disappointing, but I think it's probably true.
Are there any ways that we unlock that to make us proactively engage a little bit more? I think we're quite engaged as a specialty in general.
Oh, absolutely.
But how do we move to the next levels of that? What do we need to do?
I think sometimes looking back, and I've been doing this for nearly two decades, I've felt a bit like banging my head against a brick wall. You know, it's like, is anyone paying attention to this? Does anyone actually think this is the right thing to be doing? And I would say that when I do pause and look back, it's very clear that our profession continues to lead the way in this regard. And it's absolutely essential that we continue to do that. And I think very natural for us to do that. But if you just think about the way we teach our resident doctors, you look at our curriculum, safety is the golden thread throughout the curriculum, always has been. We've been hyper aware of risk and safety in theatre for many, many years, and the evidence in the research shows that. But if you look at the evolution of our curriculum now, the advice for educators in anaesthetics around the use of simulation, about how we embed core human factors principles in our training, it's right there. It's written down in a way that it isn't in other postgraduate curricula. And I think that where the research is concerned, again, we're at the forefront of that. And for me, it's just endlessly fascinating, the study of humans in complex, dynamic, adaptive environments. It's like there's so much that we could be doing, so much that's interesting. And I would really like us to be thinking as a specialty about how we encourage our resident doctors to think about this area of research, this highly translational area of research, as an option for them. You know, not everyone has to be a molecule doctor. Molecule doctors are important, but this is such a comfort zone for us. And I think something that we could really highlight and improve on for our trainees.
Just pondering as we're talking, obviously there's certain healthcare systems in certain areas of the world where a lot of human factors, team-based training, emergency-based training is mandated now. Is that something that we should be thinking about, or does that kind of dilute the point if we mandate that kind of training?
I think probably the simple answer is yes, we should be mandating it. There's always that slight resistance though, isn't there? As I think you're highlighting here, it's like, oh, if you're mandating it, you're telling me what to do, you know, why should I pay attention to this? I would say that I think most anaesthetists totally get that and actually would really relish it. I'm not sure that everyone feels comfortable in simulation, but I think if you set the right tone, if you get your psychological safety right, then it's always the case that it's a positive experience when you're teaching in simulation. It's quite hard work, a day in the simulator, but the work that we do with different healthcare teams is always super positive. I've never had a healthcare team leave the sim center and say, well, that was an absolute waste of my time. They all pretty much go away saying, right, I'm going to take that into the workplace. We had a really nice message from a renal registrar not long ago who'd done our dialysis emergency session, which was something actually that the renal physicians came to us and said, look, we're having these problems. We're a bit worried about certain key emergencies that can happen in dialysis that we're not really preparing our teams for. Can you help us? And we were like, oh, I wonder what you mean, you know. And there's all sorts of strangeness that can go on in dialysis that if you're not working there, you're not necessarily aware of. But we had great fun organizing that training with them, designing the scenarios, understanding what they wanted their teams to take away. And this particular registrar wrote to us, and it was a little while afterwards, actually. It was really interesting. And she said, look, I just wanted to write and say, you know, how amazing it was that training we did. And she said, I want to tell you that had it not been for the training you offered on that day, I would not have been able to manage the catastrophic hemorrhage that we had on the dialysis unit in the hospital where I work now. And I think my patient would have died. So thank you very much. It's that kind of response that really tells you why the kind of work together, train together mantra works, why it's important that we should be adopting it in healthcare. Kind of goes to the point as well about the relevance of qualitative research. You know, you can't kind of measure that in statistical terms. I think getting those sorts of qualitative case studies is hugely important. And certainly at our trust board in Oxford, it's routinely the case that we have a patient story. I know many trusts do this, but I hear those patient stories sometimes and they're really compelling. And actually, what's quite nice is that just recently, I heard a good patient story. Often, by my trust board, as I'm one of the governors in Oxford, you'll hear a story that's perhaps not led to as an ideal an outcome as you might have hoped for. But just recently, we had a super positive story from a patient with diabetes about the management of her ischemic foot. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, we need to be exploring more, understanding more, what kind of attributes within the system led to that patient getting really exemplary care.
Be interested to explore your thoughts on where we go from here in general with human factors and healthcare and anaesthesia. Just thinking along the lines of, you know, there's other excellent work that the Association and the Royal College have been involved in things like fatigue and well-being, and how we ingratiate and incorporate human factors in that kind of work, where it wouldn't traditionally, in anaesthetist, be seen as that's where human factors fits. You know, we can all see the safety checklists and the team-based learning. Is there anything that you see in terms of what might be a little bit tangential for the subspecialty interest in terms of the way it works with other subspecialty interests to try and further our learning and our understanding of it?
I mean, I think human factors is relevant across all areas of anaesthetic practice without question. And if you want to just think about a system intervention that's impacted regional anaesthesia, for example, then you've only got to look at the NR fit needles to recognize that that is a forcing function that is only allowing me to use a certain type of syringe on that needle. And it's preventing me from giving an incorrect drug to a patient, hopefully. Interestingly, though, I just recently read a little rant from a colleague of mine, Pete Hambley, on LinkedIn, where he's talking about the fact, why are we not using pre-filled syringes? I know we are in some circumstances, but not as much as we could, because the one risk that the NR-fit needle does not obviate is me putting the wrong drug into that syringe. But that would go away if we had pre-filled syringes. And I think that's been shown very nicely in oncology, where they have completely changed how they manage intrathecal methotrexate injections. Obviously, it was inadvertent vincristine that caused all the problems, you know, some 15 patients dying as a result of an accident like that over the years. But they completely changed their systems, and that included a forcing function of only allowing certain pre-filled syringes to be in the context of delivering care for patients with leukemia.
Yeah. I think you raised an interesting point with the NR-fit needles as an example of very human factors-driven work, but with a hard stop on it, so a hard outcome for it. Yeah. And I think it'd be interesting to know your thoughts about whether that is something that you can see more of happening in the future rather than the relatively soft outcomes that traditionally human factors is associated with.
Absolutely. I would like to think so. And it's certainly where some of the research work that we're doing in the group in Oxstar is definitely focused. I've just recently had a PhD student, actually, James Bowness. He's now working in London. And he looked at using an ultrasound machine that incorporates AI. So what this machine does, am I allowed to say the company name? It's Intelligent Ultrasound. There are other companies. But they devised a machine that colours anatomical structures using an AI algorithm to predict a nerve, an artery, a vein, and to support a correct decision when citing a nerve block of various different sorts, actually. But I think that kind of technology, that kind of intervention is coming, and I think we need to be right there in the middle of it, guiding that focus. It's really interesting. I work with Alison Noble, a really wonderful engineer in Oxford, who has been in the AI field for a very long time. And what's been very interesting is that I think the engineers, not just in Oxford, but in many places, have struggled to engage with clinicians. And we're suddenly doing that and seeing all sorts of opportunities. And as ever, you see that and you think, well, of course, it's about relationships. You know, like our relationships in theatre are so important to team resilience and patient safety. The same is true in research. You know, you get far better outcomes if you've got the right kind of relationships. And I think that's going to be true, particularly where AI is concerned. So we're doing work with a combination of expertise from engineering, from experimental psychology. So Charles Vincent and Nick Young working closely with looking at how we trust AI devices. So it's all very well putting a tool like that ultrasound machine into the workplace, but does the anaesthetist trust it? When you put the scanner on and it shows you a yellow blob for a nerve, do we trust it? Do we go with that decision? And it's that kind of context, that really important human aspect to the decision making that we've got to get right as well. And I think we're super well placed to do that kind of thing.
It's been called Scotland's best kept secret, Dr. Gray's Hospital in Elgin, where consultant anaesthetists come for hands-on medicine and a life that works for you. In theatre, your judgment counts. Decisions are made at the table, not lost in layers of red tape. Minutes later, you're on the coast or in the forest, home for dinner with family. Make a life, not just a living. Go to wishyouworkedhere.scot and arrange a visit to see for yourself. Flights and accommodation covered. That's wishyouworkedhere.scot.
This might be a slightly difficult question to answer. But obviously, you've had an interest in human factors for a long time.
Yeah.
And what do you think has been, if you were to pick the single biggest thing that's been human factors based, that's made a tangible difference? I'm thinking, for instance, things like the WHO checklist and things like that. Is the one thing that sticks out for you as being the moment where things changed in terms of how human factors was used in healthcare and in anaesthetics?
One thing, you said you were going to ask me difficult questions. I mean, the problem I have is that when you think about interventions to solve safety problems, there is never one magic bullet. I mean, you're right to point out that the WHO checklist is definitely a sentinel moment. I still remember when it came in my organisation and it was sort of left on the side in my anaesthetic room and everyone said, we're going to be using these now, you know, with no introduction to, I mean, you know, that's, I'm dissembling a bit because of course I knew about the WHO checklist, but what hadn't happened was it hadn't been conveyed to the rest of the professional group that this was an important intervention and that we should all buy into it. And it's taken years for us to get used to it. But now, you know, shall we, you know, at the end of a list, it's all right. Oh, we haven't signed up. It's become entirely normal. But it can't ever just be one thing. So it's like, again, back to regional anaesthesia, stop before you block. Okay, yeah, that's fine. That's one way to prevent yourself from making an error when you put in a block in. But there are many other issues around preventing distraction in the moment, around devices that we use, such as the one I've just touched on, that together have a really profound impact on safety. So I'm really going to say there's not just one thing. It's always got to be a combination of things. In all honesty, that combination has to come from the top down as well. So it has to be from the executive level saying, our organization believes in these sorts of safety interventions, this is business as usual for us. And I see that changing, certainly in my own organisation, and I know in many others. I know in Worcester you do tons of work as well, but necessarily a multimodal approach, that I wouldn't like to pick just one thing. The who is important, but it's
a very,
not the only
very
thing.
Democratic and well thought out answer.
Thank you.
I suppose probably an equally difficult question.
Excellent.
But in terms of the future, we've touched on a few things, AI being one, yeah, and human factors and the kind of the integration of that into healthcare going forward. Do you think that is the big next thing that's going to happen, or are there other things on the horizon when it comes to human factors and its interplay in healthcare?
I guess at the moment I would say that it's just incredibly exciting. There are so many opportunities in education and research where human factors is concerned that sometimes it's hard to focus. If I were going to focus, it probably would be on AI. I think there are many opportunities where AI is concerned, not just for the things that we've just touched on in clinical practice, but also in educational practice. So, for example, we're starting to look at the role of AI tutors in our VR platform. And so, again, working with Alison and the team in the Turing Group in Oxford, we're thinking about the way that we might utilise AI to support better debriefing at the end of a VR session. So one of the things we've found in implementing VR in the organization is that whilst our trainees enjoy the experience, they think it's worthwhile, what they really value is the conversation afterwards with a subject matter expert. So that might be, you know, one of us as faculty being there to talk about the management, you know, of an acute airway emergency, for example. But if you could incorporate a more effective feedback tool like an AI tutor. And I was laughing with Paul Sadler, actually. He's our regional dean. He's such a good bloke. And I said to him, I think we're going to model our AI tutor on you. We're going to have a little Paul Sadler in the VR platform telling you how it should be. So I think that there are so many opportunities, but you're right to point to AI as a really exciting avenue right now.
Yeah. You touched on something which, again, I'd be interested in asking a follow-up question to, which is the debrief. When it comes to whatever scenario you want to pick, be it a training scenario or a real scenario or both. And it seems to my mind that there has been a bit of a shift over the last few years between the debrief being something that was done because we were told it was a good thing to do and it being something that actually has benefits. Do you think debriefs in any kind of clinical scenario that requires one, informal, formal, how do you go about doing it?
Oh my goodness, you touched on another thing. I this is so important. There's so much evidence around the value of high quality debrief of psychological safety generally where simulation is concerned. And I think actually huge strides have been made in explaining this to educators in healthcare generally, but specifically to us because frankly, we do most of the simulation. Bryn Baxendale at national level, so Bryn's a good mate, and he and I have been heavily involved in simulation for many years together and in NASPE. And he's the one actually with the national team that pulled together that document that I regularly highlight, you know, as ascribing simulation as powerful in workforce development and in system design. They've put together some really superb educator modules. You know, they're quite in depth, but they're freely available on ELFH. And it interested me in the talk that not many people had seen the patient safety modules that are freely available on ELFH. The same is true of the simulation faculty modules. They're super. They're free to access. And what the national team has been trying to do is to, again, professionalise medical education, help people to understand why really good debrief, either in a pure educational setting or in a clinical setting, you know, after something has happened in theatre, be it good or bad, is profoundly important to learning. And so that kind of approach to making sure that we're delivering the same high quality in our debrief across the board, I think, is super important. And not just in anaesthesia, I mean more broadly across healthcare. But again, that's an evolution, you know, that's really at the forefront now. It's very obvious. And the work that the national team has done, I think, has been incredibly supportive of making sure that everyone's aware that professionalising medical education is exactly what we should be doing.
And again, you've just mentioned it, but it's useful to ask if the listeners are interested in shoring up their own knowledge on human factors more broadly, and human factors specifically to things like the debrief and patient safety modules. Are the resources you mentioned a good place to start for the average person that wants to shore up their knowledge?
Yeah, I think so. I think that they're certainly very good at exploring the language of human factors. I mean, much as I admire the Chartered Institutes and the International Ergonomics Association's desire to use plain language, when you say human factors to people, they instantly go, oh yeah, I know what you mean. That's all about the human and the problems with their behaviour in the workplace. That is the immediate assumption, right? And of course, it's not that at all. I mean, that's a part of it, but it's absolutely about the human at the heart of the system and the patient that we're caring for if you're applying human factors to healthcare, obviously.
I think, again, just picking up on what you said, I think the narrative seems to have shifted in general healthcare terms rather than those of us who've got an interest in human factors from it being it's all just about communication to other stuff.
Absolutely.
And do you think that is going to continue to evolve and that human factors as such will not be seen as an add-on to what we have to do, but will be seen where it deserves
just a way
to
of
be?
Thinking. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Paul. I think for me, certainly, I so much wish that I'd understood some of these principles at the start of my career, because there is no question of all the things I've learned over the years, I really believe this is what's made me a better doctor. You know, we can all learn anatomy and pharmacology and those kind of things. It's about how you apply it in the real world, in the system that you exist in, and how you do that safely. And the principles that you learn in human factors absolutely help you to do that. I've not got to the point of paralysis, though. You know, I started to think to myself, oh, my Lord, if I'm starting to thinking all the time about the system around me and how it's setting me up to fail, you know, am I going to fail? I'm not there. I find it helpful. So there are times, for example, that thing with the sticky labels that I was mentioning, you know, our magic sticky labels on our syringes. There are occasions on which I will draw up something in a syringe. Someone will come in and say something and I'll put it down and forget that I've not put the sticky label on it. And I'll just look at it and go, yeah, I know what I'm going to do now. I'm going to have to throw that away. I'm not comfortable. But that distraction in the moment absolutely impacted my performance. And so I'm able to sort of take a step back and think, maybe I should think a bit more carefully about how we keep things quiet in here. And what do I do to make that happen? People sometimes say to me, you know, how do you make sure that you do the WHO checklist properly? You can't force people to come in and well, you can actually. As the anaesthetist and the surgeon, and I work with amazing surgeons, I'm sure you all do as well, but if I just think about the way we do the WHO checklist, and I'll use my Max Fax list as an example, and Daljit Darawal is the surgeon I work with regularly on a Tuesday, and we just have this way of being in the room together. So you'll start the morning, we make sure everyone's there. We have visitors all the time, so we make sure everyone hears everyone's names and everyone understands roles and so forth. And then you model behaviour. I don't say, I'm Dr. Hyam, I'm the consultant anaesthetist. I say, I'm Helen. I'm the anaesthetist in charge of the list. And then we go around like that. Daljit does the same. And at the end of it, we'll always say, look, this is a list where we really value everyone's opinion. If you see something or you've got a question, we really, really want you to ask. And people do. And that's how you make a change in culture, by modelling those kind of behaviours. And I think that as anaesthetists, I think it's what attracted me in large part to the specialty was the people that are attracted to anaesthesia. We tend to be quite approachable, quite placid, calm, good sense of humour, you know, all of those things that build team rapport. And I think that relationship in theatre between the surgeon and anaesthetist is so profoundly important to patient safety that you really do have to take it seriously. And you do have to make it clear to other people in the room.
And a good argument for regular working relationships and regular lists.
Absolutely.
And I think you, again, as mentioned, something that is relevant for those people who might not necessarily think that human factors is their jam or that they're involved in it, which was, you mentioned in your talk about the syringe labels and the feeling of horror that we all have when we see one that isn't labeled. And I think that's probably a good example of how human factors has kind of integrated itself into just normal everyday behaviour, whether we know that we're doing it or not. You've just given this prestigious lecture. I should point out the first female that has ever been given this award and given the lecture. If you were to give some advice to yourself 20 years ago when you started all this, having just reached the point where you've given this lecture, is there anything in particular you would say? Anything that you would say in terms of this is too hard a mountain to succumb or keep going or focus on something else? Anything in particular that
it's,
you'd...
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, for me, I feel incredibly fortunate. I've trained all over the country, which I think was a really good thing. At the time I was doing it, I wasn't sure. I was a medical student in Manchester. I did my anaesthetic training in the early days in Manchester, received incredible support from people up there, great teachers, Debbie Nolan, Mark Patrick, Pete Nightinger. I mean, too many to mention. And then came down to St. George's, again, wonderful people. I mean, JP Van Bazal sticks out. He was a very sad loss, obviously, but really incredibly important in my career. George Hall and Judith Dinsmore, you know, the sort of people that you look at and think, oh, yeah, that's what I want to be like. And it could have felt very uncomfortable to me going to a totally different deanery. But team anaesthesia isn't really like that. You know, you get welcomed very quickly. And I very rapidly felt comfortable down south and then moved to Oxford. And again, you know, it's always about the people that you meet. And Pierre Foy has been an incredible influence on my career. He's such a wonderful person. I don't want to get too emotional here, but he's made a huge difference to me. He exemplifies what a good teacher and researcher should look like in anaesthesia. And then there are others I've met subsequent just through being in Oxford. People like Irene Tracy, who was our head of department until recently, a woman in science who's really led the way in her field and absolutely encouraged me when I was thinking, do I need a PhD? Do I really? You know, am I going to do it on top of my job? She goes, of course you are. That kind of thing, those relationships. And then, of course, you know, Charles Vincent, the amazing team I have in Oxstar. I think, would I advise myself any differently? I certainly wouldn't on the moves I made. I was nervous at the time. I guess what I would say to other people is, you know, take a chance. If you see an opportunity to move, I would take it. It would have been very easy for me to stay in Manchester, for example. It's a great deanery. It was a great training program, still is. But it's like, do something different.
That's I think important. You've highlighted some of the human reasons why we're in the best specialty in the world. So we all knew that anyway.
We did.
Helen, thank you very much for chatting to us on all things human factors. Please like and subscribe to the podcast. There'll be some more special editions coming out during our brief sojourn over here in Belfast. And take care. It's very nice speaking to you all. Thanks again, Helen.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Catherine Bernard, one of the anaesthetist and training representatives on the RCOA Council. I'm the clinical content lead for Anaesthesia 2026, which is going to be beside the seaside at the Brighton Centre from the 12th to the 14th of May. If you enjoyed this special conference podcast episode and want to join us online or in person for some inspiring speakers, hands-on workshops and world-class anaesthesia education, book your place at Anaesthesia 26. If you book before the 30th of December, you can get a 20% discount. Enter the code EARLY20, that's EARLY20, all capitals, no spaces, during the checkout. There'll be a booking link in the description. We can't wait to see you at Anaesthesia 2026.